we talked yesterday about the, you know, to, as we continue through our life, we still need to be that little child, to have the imagination, the creativity, the playfulness, and to, you know, but also to be responsible. And also, some of us don't, we stay in that dependent stage. And, you know, we have to move out of that and also be responsible. But I think that's what we were basically trying to say, is that in the church, I think, you know, like the other, I don't know, who were, you were here a couple days ago when we were dancing around and shaking. And I mean, I really have not, myself personally, in my Christian upbringing, have I really felt like I could do that in the church. It was like it always was really serious. People didn't clap. You couldn't talk. You know, I remember with my children, even when I was would take them to church, they had to sit
and be quiet.
And, you know, they would annoy me because they wouldn't, you know, and I thought, you know, I mean, sometimes I even feel myself when I'm in the here and I see kids running around, I think, well, no, they shouldn't be running around.
making too much noise.
So that's kind of what we talked about. And we had some questions, but the
let me throw a little bit more into that. Whitehead, she refers, yesterday I said the Whiteheads, he said, I was told that word, hey, there was a woman in there as well. So she makes the point that there are some biases that we have against play, child play. There's the bias of it's childish, and children can only play at life. They can't, you know, that's all they can do is play. And so when we talk about play for ourselves, we think that it's not appropriate because it's only playing, it's not the real thing. And then play is unreal, that is, it's pretending, it's fictitious, it's even deceptive. It might even be sinful of all things. And then it's frivolous. You're just playing around, you're not being serious. And and then Erickson, in this study, listed the sort of three characteristics of play for a child. Talks about the child leaps just out of the delight of it, for no special reason. There's no rationale. There's not some goal in mind. He just wants to leap. See how far he can leap and jump and express himself playfully. They leap against gravity. See how high you can go to, you test the limits. Play is testing the limits. Out, you know, you want to go further. And play involves falling. I mean, you're going to come down. Erickson takes these. How does a child learn out of these experiences, and what does it mean for adulthood? And the first environment that we have in which we play, but which we learn how to deal with ourselves, is the home, the parent-child relationship. And if for ourselves now as adults, it's might ask, were we encouraged to leap for delight, or were we discouraged from doing that kind of frivolous, you know, thing? Should you be quiet? Should you, you know, if you don't give expression to this delight in life? And of course, have we ourselves, we have retained this delightfulness about all that we do, whether it's our work or activities? Testing limits, were children discouraged from testing those limits? Were they expected to conform to parental expectations? Or were they free to, you know, to extend themselves? And one of the needs of childhood, we are dependent on adults. We're dependent on parents. But as we go into adulthood, we need to, in a sense, become independent. It's one of the tasks we have. And if we've had a kind of dependency in childhood, that we were allowed to test the limits and develop, you know, more self-initiative and responsibility, we're likely to have grown into adulthood with the capacity to be independent, to not be too dependent on others. Some people never learn to leave that. On the other hand, if we've testing the limits, and it's been a sort of a manipulative relationship of parent to child, as adults, we may go to the other extreme we're going to be independent, free of this controlling environment. And so that as we grow, instead of having that balance of knowing we are dependent on others right now as an adult, mature adult, as a disciple is sort of the second stage he lists people at, that I have a dependence on other people. And I can rely on that without having them control me, manipulate me, and frustrate my own sense of independence. And I can be a reliable person to be trusted as others are dependent on me. I'm not going to be abusive, manipulative, controlling, but I'm also going to encourage, I'm going to be supportive, but encouraging them in their own initiative, test the limits. And then this falling, did we see what was failure just not acceptable as a child? Are we afraid to test the limits? Are we afraid to leap? Because if we fail, then that's the one thing you must not do. Well, if we carry that into adulthood, we're liable to be a person that's fearful of experimentation. We're surely fearful to play, because if you play, you're going to fall. There's no question about it. But falling is not necessarily to be demeaning to the person. If the child falls, does the parent, you know, convey the attitude, boy, you are always falling, you're no good, you're a failure, and they internalize that, seeing themselves as a person that always fails, never achieves, never comes home with good marks, never successful, they pretty well internalize that as who they are. But rather, to fall is okay, you get up and you try again. A child does this. And as an adult, have we learned to test the limits? Have we learned to fail? And almost celebrate failure. It gives me a chance to learn something. In faith, in physics, I think the true scientist celebrates every time they discover that they were wrong.
If the experiment works, you haven't tried hard enough.
You keep trying it, so maybe you can get it to fail, and if you do, good, then you can move on. But in faith, somehow failure is, you know, boy, we've got to retain what we did in the past, we've got to retain what was done 1,000 and 5,000 years ago. Instead of delighting, if we find that in faith our previous understanding was too narrow, it was too limiting, it was constricting. Wow, to be open, to because then I come to something fuller. These are some of the things that I kind of carried along out of our first session that applied to us in adulthood. Why don't we look at some of those questions?
Okay, and the other thing that we talked about as far as the church too was that this paternalistic situation in institutions in the church, that many times the minister, priest, is the, you know, parent figure up here in the congregation are like children, and that they want to keep it that way. And the congregation, I haven't had that much experience in churches myself, so but how the minister might feel threatened, you know, when they start testing the limits, pushing, you know. So, and the same thing with the institutions that we work in. Once you start testing those limits and taking risks and doing things, then things don't work as well.
Well, can I ask a question?
Yes.
When you were talking, Jerry, about growing up in an environment where you're quite stifled, as you become older and are striving to be more independent and testing limits and so forth, depending on what kind of background you've had, it can be much more difficult. So some of this is just observation, but I mean, are we also looking at it from the standpoint of, so what do you do about it? It's a question of like recognizing it, just being more aware that this is why you're the way you are and attempting to get out from that somehow. Or on the faith track, it's there's probably a lot more variety maybe than on the other track of just growing up from an infant to an adult, where there's a lot more universal things that you're probably saying.
I think that recognizing it and then maybe starting to try to work on those stages, because and not operating out of, like, the first task of development is trust. And there are many people who are adults who do not trust. And if they never trust, they're always suspicious or saying somebody's trying to get them, or, you know, what do they want from me, all those kinds of things. They still are operating most often, even though they're very successful in their professions, their developmental stage, they're operating oftentimes in the infancy stage. And so to be able to say, you know, I am going to now try to work at getting out of this stage and, you know, finding people that you can trust and who care about you, and, you know, if you've never had parents who really met your needs, to now be able to move out of that. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, are in those stages of development. Always wanting, you know, as we are in our adolescent stage, you know, we always want approval from other people, or we're confused and, you know, all those kinds of... But I think there's a lot of people that still operate emotionally in the infant stage.
Yeah, I was also wondering along those same lines, I'm not sure how I haven't gone in any depth, but are there observations that are quite different for men and women in this? Not necessarily.
I don't know if there's been any studies. Yeah, personally, I would say women maybe are more into relationships and more open into oftentimes getting professional help, or going because this person that they're involved with, or their child or whatever, is going through problems. Maybe they will go and seek professional help and start some intervention in family counseling, and maybe some of these things will be pointed out to them.
Well, I guess the other thing that strikes me is that I'm sure, and maybe you heard yesterday, and we go in cycles, and so we may trust for a while, and then perhaps have the trust misplaced, and so then we draw back a little bit, and then we come out again, and so I guess I see these things in cycles, not necessarily a monotonic increase. We jump from one stage to another,
right,
and just stay
there.
Right,
you go in and out, go back into those stages.
It's a continuing process, evolving, which, you know,
it has cycles
more or less successful, you know. Let me... This question, when we undoubtedly, childhood experiences, youthful experience, teenage experiences have a great influence on who we are and how we handle ourselves, and that handles, there's no question. And one of the questions is, so what do you do if you discover partly I am this way because this, this, and this? And simplistically, in my mind, if you're, you know, if you read something or somebody tells you something and you're aware, oh, I'm this way because naturally I can choose to change it. Well, that's too simplistic because this is so ingrained, it's habitual, it's part of who I am now. You don't make choices simply to change it. The other extreme is, boy, you better go into deep therapy, psychotherapy, you know, whatever, to rework all this. Well, in my experience, most people that get into that trip never quite ever get out of it.
Yeah.
And that's, but I'm sure some do, but that's a toughie. And so is there some kind of middle ground? And I'm sure there is. And I'd like to explore what are some of the middle grounds to solving that kind of a problem.
I think that it's the awareness that, it's the information, getting, you know, knowledge to say, oh, I didn't know about this. Now, how can I maybe take some little steps to change it? But not to go into some, like Jerry says, therapy. But for myself, too, when I took a course with this book, Christian Life Stages, and thought, yeah, that's really true, that a lot of where we are in our developmental stages of life, you know, are the way we are in our Christian stages. And I never heard of that before, but to be able to say, yes, it's okay to have that childlike playfulness and not lose that, but also then you have to move on to other kinds of development, and to know that, you know, maybe the reason that I have this suspicion and so forth is that when I was, when I was young, I can only speak for myself. My mother and dad were married when they were 17 and 18. I was the oldest kid. My mother had four kids. You know, I don't blame my parents, but I know that a lot of the things that I feel and the things that I went through have to do a lot with the way I was as a child. So, yeah, okay, now I know that. I'm not going to sit there and dwell that my parents did the best that they knew how, but I got to move on now and say, you know, it's okay to feel those feelings, but not to get myself stuck there, but just to start moving on here now to, you know, being more responsible, being able to find out some more things about myself, meet people that are going to help me maybe get through some of those. Having a mentor, that's what Whiteheads talk about, is in the disciple part of being, you know, finding mentors that we can talk with, that we can trust, that can help us. Instead of trying to just say, I can handle it all myself. Yeah, because I didn't really let people get too close to me, even coming and talking here is not easy for me. This is a big step for me.
We thank you.
I am a person who has dealt with this need to develop from dependency in childhood to independency, hopefully on to interdependency. Mm-hmm. And there's two dangers. One is sort of try to escape dependency by becoming so independent that I'm rigidly independent. The other danger is to linger in this dependency state, refusing to accept responsibility for your own actions and all. And for me, I've kind of bought the typical American male solution, which is you got to be ready to stand alone. You know, you don't be dependent on other people. That's what a poor, manly person does. And I bought into that picture pretty easily. Whitehead, she calls this a mock maturity. It's a sort of a counterfeit maturity. And it's been a lifelong struggle for me to move to a more playful independence. I can illustrate with my three kids. My oldest son, I know I was too controlling. I had too many expectations. I laid a lot of stuff on him. I think it wasn't terrible, but my second, 6 years later, happened to be a daughter. I think I did a better job of allowing her to be herself without me imposing myself on her. But not all that much. Then a third son came along 11 years after my daughter. By this time, you know, I am a little more mature, I think. And I was much more relaxed, allowing him to be himself. Now, actually, I'm sure I can see this in their personalities, their strengths and their weaknesses. And there's always strengths and there's always weaknesses. But I've watched my own development as an example, as a pastor. If I can control situations, I can pretty well eliminate failures. And so, an example. Last night, we did matins. They came up in the afternoon and said, "We haven't got anybody to do matins tonight, would you do it?" I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Hey, Gail, why don't you do it with me? You know, we're teaching this session together. Why don't we do matins?" And 25 years ago, when I was in the disciple stage, as they listed, I would so construct the situation that there was, I had it all totally under control. And I was going to manage it so that, you know, you had guaranteed failure or unanticipated happenings.
You would have directed the choir last night.
I would have directed the choir.
Incense.
Gail, why don't you help do this thing with me? And Katie, they said we should use these songs. Why don't you take care of everything? Now, you don't get the same guaranteed results this way, but for me it's much more satisfying, and there's much freedom, and there's relaxation and enjoyment. And I play a little bit now, a little bit, when I plan something. And oftentimes the unanticipated is better than what I had intended to happen. And what I'm talking about is I'm struggling in my own growth to develop a independence that is an interdependency. It's a trusting. It's being able to be open and be dependent on others, even as I can be a dependable and reliable strength to others. And I'm making a little progress in this. I got a long ways to go. But you ask a question. How do we cope, you know, when we you have something in mind.
If you're not aware of some of these things, that's a big strike against you right from the start. But I think even when you're aware, I can go back to like what you said, there are still these things that you can't change now, these things that happened 20, 30 years ago. You can be aware of it and you can understand it and you can say you want to change, but it's not necessarily that easy. Okay? And I'm relating to some of the things that you talked about as far as I feel like I probably was independent to a large degree at an early age, like teenager or whatever. And there's a lot of positives with that as far as I'm concerned. But as I got older, I think I became more and more aware that I was missing out on a lot. And some of that stuff, I relate to this man-woman thing to a degree because I think I've learned so much from my wife. We also came from, both from large families, but kind of differing backgrounds as far as the relationships within the families. And again, you know, you learn from those things. But it's still not that easy to be the way you want to be.
But why don't we ask, just how many of us feel if we had a problem one way or the other, we strive to be independent, maybe too fast or too strongly, or that we lingered in dependency and not taking up our own initiative and independent actions. How many of us would say, my problem was that I sort of strove to be independent too quickly, and that if I got a problem, it's that way. Who would say that was true for them?
I know I didn't want to be dependent for a long, long time.
Okay. And yours was to be too dependent.
Too dependent, a domineering mother.
Well, I was wondering if the women would say one thing and the men would say another. That's what I was trying to get at. But.
Probably some of it has to do with position and family. I mean, I was the oldest of four.
That does have a lot to do with it.
I think that, I know just from lots of studying that, and I think most of us know that the roles that for men and women, when men, you know, when little boys are separated from their mothers, they're told, you need to grow up, you need to go out. So the boys are socialized to be strong, to move on, to move away from their mothers. And the studies will show that over and over again, where we as girls we're not socialized that way. And so even if you want to raise your sons to be more sensitive, to be in a different way, even if you have a little boy and you say, okay, I'm going to raise him that way, he will be teased and, you know, discriminated by his peer group. If he wants to be sensitive, soft, you know, he's got to be strong, like, you know, the football players or all the different messages that men and women get. I think it's getting better, but they show that mothers, you know, you don't want to be a mama's boy. You need boys detach from their mothers, and girls don't.
That's a remarkable thing. I was just thinking back to my childhood, back in the 30s. I was born in 1930, and we had a cottage up in Michigan where we would go for the summer. And there were four of us children, two boys and two girls, and also relatives around there too. And I can remember on rainy days, all of us sewing doll clothes. I sewed doll clothes. And the girls dug for worms, and we all went fishing together. It was not tight. Mm-hmm.
I think that was exceptional.
That was the exception, but yes. In general, it's not that. That was healthy.
Yes.
That was it. You know, there's 5% of us that come from nurturing, loving, caring families, and the rest not healthy.
Right.
And you know, that's, you know, there's so many expectations and messages that we get.
What ages were you when you say you sewed the doll clothes?
I was probably 4 to 10 years old. Okay. In there.
Could you have continued that, say, when you were 13 or 15?
I still had things like that.
And our boys did too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, our youngest son is one of the best cooks that I know. He's vegetarian. He likes it that way, but picked it up on his own. And the girls, I guess Penny isn't quite so.
Sure, she is. She can do one.
What about people that grow up and then continue to be dependent on their spouse? Kind of real dependent. And
transfer the dependency.
Spouse. That happens too, doesn't it? Mm-hmm.
I mean, an unhealthy dependence on your spouse.
Way, yeah, right.
I see that as a nurse in the hospital. all the time, particularly in the age group, I'd say 60-year-old on up, where the roles of, I mean, of course, it could be younger, but the man who is, most of the time, it will be a man.
Okay.
Who, he has his menu to, you know, he chews your menu, breakfast, lunch, supper. And our, you know, John, are you going to fill up your menu? Oh, no, I'll wait till my wife comes. She'll do it. Do you know, now we're going to talk about your medications. my wife takes care of that. A lot of, you know, well, you know, what would happen if your wife, you know, she died, she got sick, you know, you need to be responsible here. Well, then the wife comes in. And then you bring up the subject, and the wife gets mad at you, you know. So it's kind of like, what stage of development are they operating at?
Almost a codependency.
Yeah,
codependency.
Just a real childlike. I mean, you know, the parent-child kind of relationship going on here.
Okay, she gets mad at you for asking her, you mean?
Yeah, well, say, you know, I know that you take care of John's medications, but, you know, I really want to, you know, discuss this with you, and I think it's real important that he knows.
Oh, I see.
You know, and then she can just tell. She's
threatening.
She's taking it away from
her. Yeah, this is threatening to her.
Yeah.
Okay.
But at least it's worth trying, you know, and pointing it out, and maybe they might make some changes. Because when people get mad at you, you know that you've touched something.
True.
And I'm sure that goes on in the church. I mean, you know, we don't want to just talk about just Nick. It's kind of talking, this needs to be incorporated in what goes on in our Christian life, too.
It's pretty fertile ground, though, when you can get under somebody's skin or take away their role or function, and they do become angry at you. I mean, how you deal with that strong emotion, I mean, because their identity is being, I would imagine, being threatened or being, you know, you can't have him decide for himself. I mean, that's my job. Or I mean, how would you deal with that when you are faced with this situation? It's,
you know, it's easier just to ignore it.
Is that just the easy way out, though?
Yeah, I think it is. And it takes a lot of courage and a risk to confront it.
Yeah.
And as, you know, I'm only speaking in my own, you know, nursing role and, you know, saying to people, confronting this type of situation, and then they'll become angry and say, "You seem very angry." And then, "I'm not angry at all," you know. But maybe somehow or other, you have done some kind of an intervention and you have really taken the risk. And it's scary, you know, because I've had people, you know, some people say, "Oh, I'm going to report you to the supervisor. I'm writing to the president of the hospital." I say, "Well, then maybe that's what you should do."
Yeah.
And it's hard.
Yeah.
But I've had some positive results from it.
Yeah.
And I think that's operating in more of the adult stage.
Sure.
To take and do those kinds of things. And even with my own children, to say, "Well, you know, if you have to live on the street, I'm not going to give you money, and you're going to have to just figure it out."
Sure.
I think we have to be a little careful, though. There's an appropriate place for fulfilling some roles. And if we're in a role compulsively, or if we're there because there was no escape from it, that's probably bad. But I think you can choose roles in relationships. And you can depend on, see, in my wife and my relationship, we, you know, I guess at some point she's going to die. I am going to be handicapped because I'm so dependent on her in so many different ways. And yet, it's sort of a chosen dependency. I'm aware of it. She's aware of it. I think I'm a healthier person because there is this kind of dependency. I don't have, and I think there is, we almost can convey that somehow we ought to be almost fully independent of one another. We should all roles should just be interchangeable or something. Well, I don't think that's very realistic. I mean, I'm a different person, and I think that on a staff team in ministry, hey, some people have some skills, and I think we ought to operate generally out of our strengths, not out of our weaknesses. And as long as you're aware and you can celebrate, I think one of the keys, if we get angry when somebody punctures our neat little system we've devised, then we're probably not aware, and it's probably something that we're not acting freely with. But when somebody punctures that bubble and you can laugh at it, I find it's the same. Overcoming some of the limitations that we've, you know, from childhood or from our past, if we're aware and can laugh about how we're captive to something, maybe we're well along to being free of being victimized by our past. You can laugh at it. It's no longer threatening to you. And one of my associate pastors one time, I remember, we started at, what is it that gripes us about one another? And he made a nice list. I had a little less, a longer list than I did. But we could talk about it. We were laughing. And of course, the very reason he chose to come to be an associate with me was the very things that he also listed. These are your strengths. I wanted them. I'm here. Sometimes it irritates me. But and as long as we were aware, we could work together, and we could give that permission to each other to operate according to our abilities.
We just went through a situation like that where that did not happen, where they didn't come together and explain it. And the senior pastor, I think, was stuck in his role of controlling, and it turned out pretty bad. But anyway.
And the associate pastor was a young man, and he had a lot to learn, a lot of strengths, but some weaknesses. And rather than mentoring and helping, it became a real power struggle. And in fact, it degenerated to such a point that the district president came in and really urged both folks to leave. But the senior pastor got a very attractive call and fit his capabilities, but wouldn't take it because the junior pastor was still there.
But then he finally did.
Finally, the junior pastor left and then the senior pastor left. So it's just a difficult situation.
You were going to talk some about mentoring today as a...
Well, in the disciple.
In the need for a disciple.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we were going to talk about, the disciple. which is an adult who both initiates and follows. And I'm just thinking, like, the word disciple itself means a learner. And I wonder, to me, the disciple seemed to be someone, in my childlike thinking, what I learned in church was, you know, you follow. Disciple, Jesus said to follow me, that you follow. But I didn't think of it as much as in terms of a learner. And I wonder, when you talk about that, how many ministers, I don't want to attack ministers, but I...
Ministers are just folks too.
Yeah.
They really are.
But I wonder how many ministers are willing to learn. And, you know, when...
It turns out lots of them are.
But we as a congregation, I don't see them.
We put expectations
on them. We keep them there so that they are free to.
Yeah, a conversation just the other day. How are you doing? Fine. How fine? Tell me about fine. And it isn't until you get beyond that first fine that you begin to really see the person. And that's true of pastors, that's true of lay people, that's true of everyone.
Mikhail, I'm interested in hearing what are the signals that come from pastors that tell you that they don't want to learn? What are the kinds of signals we give that sort of tip off, or that sort of give that impression?
Well, as I told you yesterday, you know, I left the organized church about 4 years ago because I just found that what I was seeing in the church I had to sit back.
Yeah.
And this particular minister, just very arrogant, very self-egocentric, but maybe if I would, you know, and I did talk to him a couple of times, and just seemed very, you know, patriarchal, and I just decided I needed to leave. So I just thought he came across as being not anyone who was willing to hear or to...
Oh, yeah. Not approachable.
No. Okay. And I had belonged to that church for quite a few years. And I maybe it was just my own always sort of feeling more like the child. And, you know, maybe myself putting the minister in that position of being more like the father figure.
But no, it's interesting though, because I'm sure a lot of times we do give off those signals that can be interpreted that way.
What are some of those signals as you see them?
Well, just the not being very approachable, I suppose, would be one, of being defensive. I'm interested in hearing that from people who watch pastors, because since I'm a pastor, I'd be interested to hear what it looks like.
And I also see, as a nurse, the ministers coming to and the priests that sure. come in and see patients frequently, really seem not really sensitive. I mean, they come in, they read the Bible, they read this Bible stuff to them, and then they say, well, you know, and they're not really sitting down and holding their hand and, you know, listening to them and saying, you know, what can I do?
Okay.
Or, you know, some really caring, sensitive, because those people, when the minister comes in the room, if they call the minister, you know, that person is coming to meet some of their spiritual needs, to really meet those needs instead of saying, oh yeah, I gotta go and see this person, they're dying of cancer, and to, you know, there are some, yes, but I don't see a lot of them. They sort of just stand there in that kind of that role.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, why did you come here? You know, I think I'd rather call the hospital chaplain, who would really come in and sit down, hold their hand, and really listen to them for, you know, maybe 15 minutes or half an hour.
That might be a different a situation is where they're not comfortable with their own death and dying.
The minister, you
mean, or the priest. And they have a hard time then reaching out to someone who's in that position. I've certainly seen that in the hospital.
Well, and people have different strengths too, like you say, you know, if pastors living or working together, some pastors are probably just, I know in our situation, in the church we belong to, there is one pastor that is definitely more of the type that will sit there and listen and always seems like he has time, and that is his role as the caregiving pastor. Not that the other two are not caring and whatnot, but their strengths are probably in some of the other lines. And I know that we've got one that, you know, but right now I think that all three of our pastors are, I could go to any one of them and I would feel that they would be there to listen to me. But we haven't always had that, and I think that everyone has different strengths too.
And I don't know what the percentage of churches is that has only one pastor. And there are probably a lot of pastors that are not comfortable with that role, just as I would not be comfortable with that role. And it's
but I think
difficult to look for that in everyone. I mean, it's just an observation. But.
Well, you know, I think we have to be careful, too, that we don't put the expectation of perfection on the pastors. And I think this senior pastor who was rigid and authoritarian and so on, gospel was preached beautifully from the pulpit.
Right.
Funerals were conducted caringly. It was a beautiful gift. And we accept it for that.
One of the facts are that some of what's required of pastors is that they get things done. The place gets organized. Services are held.
And so you just
the person that's caring They never get up on it, you know? And so you have different conflicts. I sense this in myself. I'd like to be this, but...
But the other thing is they're not free enough to let somebody else take over that part, the layperson.
Sometimes. And we have filled, we have sat at the side, bedside folks dying and stuff.
We're comfortable with that position.
For years. That's been kind of our call.
That's correct.
But we have to accept that. The present pastor we've got in New York, neat guy, very high churchy, very liturgical, he likes incense and stuff like that. We say, Dale, knock it off. Some of the folks here don't like it. Some of them are allergic to the incense. So they don't come to church when he has it. I say,
but
no.
We can talk to him like that.
But I think part of the course is to not only for ourselves, but for other people to be able to know that there are these different stages. And to say, well, that's where they're operating. Yeah. And, you know, maybe we can be mentors and we can, in a gentle way, say,
that's a good
teach
point.
Them, mm-hmm. not to judge them. Right. I'm not judging.
Yeah,
but I just say that, you know, it's
smart.
Just part of an ongoing process of maturity to be able to learn these things about ourselves and to say, you know, there, if you want to change, you know, yeah. only that person can change.
Mm-hmm. And just to go back to one more time, would you say, Gail, it's the difference between a caring attitude on the part of a pastor or non-caring? Is that what you call it? Would it be part of it? A really caring attitude, a caring approach, or not?
I mean, as far as in the hospital scene?
Yeah, hospitals or anywhere as far as...
I think maybe person. Underneath, maybe there is. Maybe they feel that this is the image they have to have. Maybe they are, and they just, it's not, you don't see it.
Or the ability to let people know that you care. Yeah.
I have had some ministers come up to me as the nurse and tell me things that have helped me that, you know, that have been very concerned and say, mm-hmm. you know, this person has been going through this and she has, you know, the reason she is mm-hmm. behaving this way, like this one particular woman, she would not let any of us really even get close to her, putting on this, you know, angry, you know, we had a really hard time, and he then came and told me and spent about 30 minutes sitting and telling me all this history, which then I was able to pass on to other people to say, well, you know, we need to approach her from this, you know, this way,
yeah.
because she has been had all this pain and so forth and so on. So in that, you know, in that instance, it was very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, this is helpful to hear some of this because we often like Jerry said, just go about our work and don't stop to think what effects we're having and whether we could be a lot better in relating to people's needs.
Our time is up, and at least one of us has a class to teach the next hour. This now. Talk about lack of continuity. This will now be, the third session will be Friday at 6:50, so that's all. It's always I have to make one comment. I would appreciate if you would refer to those of us who are called clergy. Call us pastors, not ministers, because when we say minister, I insist that we're talking about you and you and you, as well as people that are clergy. Pastors, priests, what? But I don't think we can. I don't want the total church to escape doing the ministry.
So we're all ministers. We're all ministers.
Yeah, I think we need to undergird that. And we didn't talk all that much about discipleship, and yet we did, because what Whiteheads are encouraging is that this maturing is a journey. It isn't bang, 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 or anything. It's a journey, and it's always growing, evolving. Their emphasis is on being somewhat playful. Our tendency is not to have this ingredient as part of it. It'll be delightful, enjoyable, got to dare to dance in the midst of life. And I'm only sorry that we didn't hear more some insights from the sort of...
I'm on the other side of the fence here. I'm still kind of like, my life is, you know, I'm kind of halfway in years behind a lot of folks, so I'm just listening.
Gee, I was thinking I was just about halfway.
I've got a quarter.
That's all that individual.
Jerry, thank you very much.
We come in like this, leave the same way.
Very good. We have to be in.